funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did we learn to speak, not as individuals, but as a species? While some scientists believe language grew out of the urgent need for early human hunters to communicate during the dangerous business of stalking prey, my guest today has a radically different and entirely compelling theory. Dean Falk is Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University. She traces the origins of human speech, along with singing and even art, to the first generations of mothers who walked fully upright. Since they had to put their infants down occasionally in order to get things done, as mothers today do, they would have used coos and calls to comfort their lonely babies from a distance. And it makes sense that the babies would have cooed and called in response. She explains her thinking in a new book called Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. Dean, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You believe language, or at least proto-language, predates modern humans. How far back does our verbal communication go?
Well, we can't be exactly sure of how far back. We do know that we share a relative with chimpanzees that lived between 5 and 7 million years ago. After that division, certain things would have happened within our own lineage that would have seeded the origins of language. So I put it many millions of years ago, but we can't at this point say exactly when that would have been.
Yeah, it seems like such a challenging thing because the fossil record can't tell you anything about what utterances we made.
That's true, but there is lots of other evidence in the fossil record which is informative in terms of anatomy and physiology of the body, and that bears on the question, and also of the brain, and that certainly does. So there's evidence in the fossil record, and there's evidence in comparative studies of monkeys, apes, and humans, and also looking at various people around the world and their behaviors. So if you put all those pieces of the jigsaw puzzle together, we can begin to make reasoned speculation about this interesting topic.
Yeah, one thing we know for certain is that our brains started getting progressively bigger, which was good for the intellect and perhaps for our survival, but bad for childbearing.
Yes. We know that at the bottom of our lineage, something very dramatic happened, which is our ancestors shifted from moving on four limbs to walking on two limbs. And that had drastic consequences for the size and shape of the birth canal. In order to walk, muscles became rearranged and the bones became shaped differently so that the bony pelvis became very constricted. That, in conjunction with increasing brain size, made giving birth very, very difficult in our ancestors compared to the other higher primates, compared to monkeys and apes. And as we know today, it's excruciatingly difficult for women to bear children. And it's a consequence of those anatomical changes many millions of years ago to do with both walking on two legs or bipedalism and the enlarging brain.
So what happened at that point was that some babies were born what at the time was a sort of premature, at a premature time. They could potentially survive that, but then they required a great deal more attention from their mothers than their ancestors might have had.
Yes, I think what happened was these were really hard times for early hominids. I think a lot of babies died, and I think a lot of mothers died in childbirth. The survivors were the mothers of infants that happened to be born very small and relatively undeveloped. In other words, there's a range of variation, and it was the late bloomers that survived. So they ended up completing their gestation, if you will, externally after they had been born. And a consequence of this was that physically they did not develop the motor skills the way our ape cousins and monkey cousins do. So they lost the ability that little tiny monkey and ape infants have of clinging autonomously to their mothers. You know, monkey moms and ape moms can move freely using all four extremities. They don't have to hang on to their babies because their babies hang on to them. And this would not have been the case for our early ancestors. Babies would have lost that ability, and I think there was a time of severe natural selection when only some survived. And that left mothers with a problem, which is, how to move around and collect food and travel and keep their little nursing infants with them. And the solution would have been, walking on two limbs, to use the forelimbs, the arms and hands, to carry their babies, to carry them on a hip or carry them in their arms.
This was before the technology existed. And it's funny to use that word, but putting a baby in a sling would have solved that, but that didn't happen for thousands of years.
Yes. We don't know for sure when baby slings were invented, but there's no evidence that they were really, really old. We know walking on hind limbs is really old. We have fossils that show that. It was millions of years old, over 3 million and maybe even 5 million or older. But in terms of baby slings, there's no evidence even for stone tools older than 3.2 or million, something, and usually the date given is 2.5 million for stones. So in terms of textiles or even weaving together vegetation or using leather, it would be relatively recent. The oldest date, I think, might have been somewhere between 1.6 and 1.8 million years ago when Homo erectus was hunting and doing so in a more organized way than its ancestors, in which case there would have been leather. So I suspect the first baby slings were made of leather. But this would have been long after the events that we talked about earlier, about the, you know, the mothers having to carry their infants. So it would have been in their arms. And there were times when they would have simply had to put them down right next to them. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want to leave them somewhere and wander too far away because you might not have a baby when you went back.
And as we all know, distressed babies love nothing more than to be touched. But for a mom who was busy gathering food or engaging in some task, they would use their voices instead.
Yes. And we know with our infants, they cry for a variety of reasons, but one of the big ones is they want to be held and picked up, and they want that constant contact, which is very natural because it's just ingrained in our history. And they signal this by crying, and we soothe them or we put them in baby carriers or playpens. But the early hominid women and mothers would have simply set them down, and a way of shushing them would have been to shush them and to coo at them and to make reassuring noises and maybe to have a little music in their little lullaby, sort of melodic vocalization. And I think it began then. And the infants, for their part, would have fussed the way even a chimp, if it happens to fall off of its mother. That doesn't happen very often. But when it does, they'll fuss a little. They'll whimper. So I think there was an evolution both in the babies, in their crying. And we know that human babies cry differently than ape babies. So I think the babies' cries started evolving, and the mother's vocalizations towards the babies began evolving. And these were substitutions, part-time substitutions, for the physical contact. They substituted for the cradling arms on a temporary basis.
And in fact, this is fascinating to me. You actually see a relationship between the neural pathways for physically reaching and grasping and the pathways for language.
Yes. And that's the last chapter, the brain chapter, you know, chapter 9 of the book. But the beginnings have to do with this reaching and grasping and how little infants lost, you know, that ability and the consequences. But if we look at the modern neurosciences, the people doing applying medical imaging techniques to studying questions about the brain and language, a theory that has a lot of credibility right now is that the language parts of the brain were co-opted or tinkered from hand representations in the brain that have to do with reaching out and grasping objects.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, animals, including non-human primates, use extremities such as hands to explore their environments, to grasp their environments. They might bat something with a paw, for instance. This is how they articulate with their environments. And so it's fascinating to me that it looks as if our language areas with which we grasp mentally our environments were tinkered or molded or taken over, co-opted from these hand representations in the brain. And mind you, it's not that these areas only do one thing. Areas do multiple duty. Brain areas do multiple duty. So, yeah, and I think it's beautiful. It's so cyclical, and it, to me, it makes complete sense.
Dean Falk is my guest. She is Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University. We're talking about her new book, Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. If you'd like to join our conversation, we welcome you to call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We will also welcome you to call 1-800-456-5372 or go online to the support page at kera.org. Become a new or renewing member of the station. Remember, everyone who makes a contribution during this membership campaign will be enrolled in this drawing we have going for the British Airways trip for two to London with a $1,000 Marriott gift card and a tour of the BBC studios. If you are interested in getting a copy of Dean's book, Finding Our Tongues, we have that available today at the $120 contribution level. You can call the volunteer at 800-456-5372. You can even do this online at kera.org. There's a place to look at all the potential thank you gifts. If it's something that you want to pick up anyway and you want to support KERA, we are delighted to be able to make this available to you. But as we always remind you, we know and you know we're not selling you this book for $120.
No, it's got a price tag in it. You can go to the the bookstore. You can order it online. It's really again, Chris, I'm so excited to be able to say thanks to Jeff Wolf in Fort Worth and Robert Jacob in Duncanville, because I'm terrified that no one's going to call and pledge, because this is so interesting. Both hours today, quite honestly, really, really captivating. If you are enjoying this conversation with Dean Falk, if you're if you get excited about conversations about anthropology, we know that some of you do, because we hear from you. We've heard from David Pulley in Dallas. We've heard from Paul LaRocque in Arlington. Thanks to each of you for making your contribution. Perhaps you would like to get a copy, as Chris said, of Dean's book, Finding Our Tongues. You can join at the $120 membership level. It's $10 a month when you become a sustaining member of the station, and you can have your very own copy of the book.
Or if you want to get the book independently, you can also make your entire contribution. We know a lot of you don't take a thank you gift, and that's fine too. Don't feel obligated to take something. In that case, we'll just put your entire contribution toward the cost of programming. But look, we're happy to be able to offer this to you, and it's our pleasure to be able to say thank you. The best way we know to really serve you is to give you the programming you care about. But we have lots of different thank you gifts if it's something that appeals to you. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. I want to thank David Owens in Coppell, Lisa Weingert in Rockwall, and thank you for your support of the station. Public radio exists because we all believe it's important, and we give our dollars and we make it happen.
It is your public radio station, and it is funded in large part by you. You know, Christian, you're talking about to take a thank you gift or not take a thank you gift. I think about the whole, like, I've taken my own grocery bag to the grocery store thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it used to be paper or plastic, and you say, well, I've got my own bag. And you know, now when you join the station, you know, it was like tote bag or mug,
you know,
and you say, no, I'll just take the programming. So it's really up to you. I mean, we're absolutely thrilled to provide you with KERA's very own Think Mug.
We do have mugs and tote bags, by the way, so don't worry. We haven't changed that much.
Of course, the tote bag is now the reusable shopping bag, and it's made from recycled plastic fibers. And
green chic.
Yeah, it's very cool. So, you know, it's totally up to you, but you've already chosen to listen. We just hope that you'll choose to take the very next step, just like Sian, Brandon, and Watauga did, and become the next new or renewing or additional gift, the next contributing listener to KERA.
Yes, any amount that you choose to give us is welcomed and appreciated. You may be in a place where you can do $10,000. You may be in a place where you can do $10 a month. That is entirely up to you. You set the level, and you let us know how much you value public radio. The telephone number is 1-800-456-5372, or you can take care of this on the support page at kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hale G. Smith, Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University, Dean Falk. Her new book is called Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. We have it available with our compliments at the $120 membership level today at 1-800-456-5372. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Dean, I want to talk about what you call mother ease and what it is today and then how it relates to what we were doing millions of years ago.
Okay. Mother ease is something we're all familiar with. It's baby talk, and you've probably done it yourself. If you haven't, you can see it by going somewhere where there are mothers and babies, a playground, a grocery store, a restaurant. It's a special way of speaking to babies, which has a higher pitch. It's very musical. It's sometimes called musical speech. So it's melodic. It's slow. It's very repetitious. When parents use this, and fathers do it too, they tend to speak in the here and now, and sometimes use special baby words.
Mm-hmm.
So it's baby talk. And part two of your question was, how does it relate to the past?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we know that only people do baby talk. Other animals have contact calls between mothers and infants. But humans are the only primate that has this sort of incessant, special way of vocalizing. So we have to ask, where did it come from in terms of evolution? And that's how we get back to speculating, as we did a little while ago, about what went on between mothers and infants. I focus on women because the comparative model that we always use is chimpanzees. And with chimpanzees, we don't know who the fathers are, nor do they. There's no concept of paternity. So to do the comparisons, I focused on mother-infant pairs. And this came up at a conference that I attended about 12 years ago when I heard a woman called Ellen Desaniaki talk about the evolution of dance and mime and music, and she related that to Mother Eve. And I thought her talk was brilliant and fascinating, and that got me thinking about the question of how and where did Mother Eve evolve. And it didn't take long to realize that the function of Mother Eve today, one of the functions, is that it helps infants acquire their languages. You know, their babies are born without language, and by the end of their first year, they're becoming linguistic. And a lot of what they need to know in order to make that transition is embedded in Mother Eve. And so it's unconsciously conveyed to them by the people that speak Mother Eve to them.
And it makes perfect sense to me that the musicality of Mother Eve is not such a big leap between, are you tired, are you ready for bed, to singing a lullaby.
Yes. And it may be that lullabies even preceded Mother Eve. Mm-hmm. Both are universal. People everywhere sing lullabies to their infants. And Mother Eve is universal. That was somewhat controversial because there were some studies done in the 1970s that suggested a few cultures did not have Mother Eve. But I've looked into those cultures. I've read the primary literature. And in fact, they do have Mother Eve. It's just that it's constrained to fit societal norms in those cultures. But what Mother Eve does is, well, initially, when mothers speak to their babies in Mother Eve, what they're doing is conveying love and emotions, and babies love it. As the infants mature, mothers will use Mother Eve to be instructive. If you see the baby scooting across the floor towards the light socket, rather than saying, no, dear, don't go there, no, will get the job done.
Yeah.
But also, what it's doing, what parents are doing, is they're unconsciously underscoring the speech sounds that the babies need to learn in order to understand what a speech stream is, you know, where one word stops and another begins. So this is another function of the kinds of parent infant vocalizations that we humans do.
And it's fascinating to consider the fact that this is not just a verbal way of expressing oneself. This goes to facial expressions and gestures.
Yes, that's very, very important. We tend to think of baby talk as just that, baby talk, only the vocalizations. But language in general is more than just vocalizations. There's body language in there, and there's facial expressions, and there's tone of voice. And all of that joins with the actual spoken words to convey meaning. And the same is true for mother ease. And so the gestures are, we gesture differently towards our babies. Again, it's unconscious, but we emphasize the meaning by sweeping, slow, dramatic gestures. And facial expressions are exaggerated when we're communicating with babies. And again, it's underscoring for them what language is and what the meaning is. And so it's helping to, quote, bootstrap language.
And of course, half the fun of this is that before too long, there's a sort of call and response taking place between mother and baby or adult and infant.
Yes. And you know, it's not even before too long. It seems to be almost from birth that babies are imitating. There's a scientist out at University of Washington in Seattle named Andrew Meltzoff, and he studied this. I once saw him give a talk and was fascinated. He had photographs of babies that were just like a week old doing things like sticking their tongues out in response to adults doing that, moving their hands in certain ways. So imitation is there from the get-go. It seems to be innate. And with mother ease and with the cooing and with the singing, it's not a one-way street. The baby responds. It may coo and gurgle and kick its little legs or laugh, but it's almost like a conversation, like a cyclical conversation.
I realize, Dean, that all we can do is speculate about this, but what do you think the earliest words must have named?
Yes, isn't that fun?
It's a great question, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Well, we can look around the world to the earliest words of infants all over the world, and they're often names of important people, like Mama and Dada, or names for animals, or body parts, this sort of thing. And I think it's possible that during evolution, that the first words might have been names for things, like people and animals. And so I see possible parallels there. It's been suggested by various people over the years that Mama, or its equivalent, depending on the language, would have been a likely first word. And I must say I like that idea. But you're right. Without a time machine, we probably will never know. But it is fun to think about. I have one colleague, Stephen Miffin, who thinks that it might have been something like, as parents discourage their infants from putting things in their mouths. Mm-hmm. And he says that his wife disagrees, and she says, no, it might have been something like num, 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 as parents try to encourage their children to eat certain foods.
Well, it makes sense to me that these words would have developed within family groups and between parents and their children. But there's a huge leap between that and standardizing language, even among other adult members of a group. Can you talk about what you think happened there?
Yes, and that is a really important question. And what we can do, you know, to ask this idea about how once something's invented, let's say a word or a vocabulary, how does it spread and become conventionalized across a population or even between populations? And we can look to some studies of higher primates. In this case, they're macaque monkeys from Japan, Japanese macaques, which are pretty famous because these macaques, which the studies began on them in the late 1950s and 1960s. And what happened there was they invented certain things. A classic example is they were provided with sweet potatoes that were left out on the beach for them, and they were all gritty with sand. And one particular macaque, a female adult named Emo, invented the habit of rinsing the potato off in salt water. And so she was seasoning it and cleaning it off. And that spread amongst all the monkeys eventually, and then it was transmitted vertically through the generations. So it's going on today, and they all do it. So it was a proto-cultural invention. And the way that spread was there was one inventor. Her offspring learned it from the mother, and then they taught the other infants in their play groups, because these monkeys do that. They'll have little infant play groups. And then they took it home to their nuclear families, to their moms and siblings. The last to learn were the males, who were the adult males who were off doing guy things. So you had a horizontal transmission through, happened to be a female inventor and the infants, and then eventually it went to everybody, and then eventually vertical through the generations. And there have been other inventions by these macaques, wheat washing, and they're still inventing things, by the way, that have spread this way. So that's one example. The question about vocabulary origins and spread have been modeled by mathematicians who, as far as I can tell, didn't even know about the Japanese macaques. And they came up with that exact same model as a likely way for vocabularies to become conventionalized. And then there's one other piece of evidence, which is a language, a sign language called Nicaraguan Sign Language, has been invented in the modern day in the last 30 years or so. And it's now a full-blown sign language. These were deaf children in Nicaragua, where initially they lived in their own homes and did not go to school. And so they had individual signs that they had invented to communicate with their own families. They're called home signs. And then in the 1970s, a school was created for them. So these children got together, and on the playground, they evolved, they invented a language between them by adopting some of the signs. It was sort of a natural selection of signs where they would all end up agreeing on which ones they would use. And as new generations of children came into the school, they enlarged upon it, and it became more formally linguistic. In other words, today it's a completely formal language, and it was invented and spread by children. So I think if we look at all those things together, we have a reasonable model of what might have happened in prehistory. And what you would need is for something like this to happen, as did with the Japanese macaques, and then a population explosion. And then you've got a group that's linguistic.
Dean Falk is my guest. She is Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University. We're talking about her new book, Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. We'll resume our conversation in just a few minutes, but wanted to take a quick break to ask you to become a member of KERA, either renew a membership, initiate a membership, or possibly make an additional gift, because we know that you value the content here at KERA. The telephone number to call is 1-800-456-5372. If you're interested in getting a copy of Dean's book, it is one of the thank you gifts we have available at the $120 level. I have, as Jeff knows, one of my sisters just had a baby yesterday, and the other had a baby 3 months ago. And
congratulations.
Now I can't decide which of them will get my copy of the book first.
Aunt Chris.
Auntie Chris. I'm very excited. But it's a really interesting read. If it's something that you'd like to pick up and you're ready to support KERA, why not do it all at once?
1-800-456-5372, online at kera.org. Whether you're ready to admit it, my friend, you have already initiated a relationship with KERA. It's a thing. It's an entity. It's a character. It's a group of people who invade your brain through the radio that you listen to, that you expect to be there, that you know you're going to get something from. And what we're doing now is we're asking you to say, you know, to go ahead and embrace that. Come to terms with it, agree with, and sort of not even necessarily in a very public way, but in a very affirmative way, reinforce that relationship by helping to support the radio station at 800-456-5372 or online at kera.org. And you know what? We're talking about money. We're talking about sending cold, hard cash to the radio station. That's all. It's whatever, however many dollars, however many bills. Whatever level's right for you. We say it all the time, but it boils down to this. It costs money to exist in this society. We haven't yet been able to figure out how to run the radio station on chickens or on
they cost money too,
or on corn or something. You know, so we're asking you to do this, and it's really easy. It's so easy, and we just hope that you'll be the next one to call.
1-800-456-5372 is the number. You can also go to kera.org. Last hour, we had Sister Helen Prejean in here, and off mic when we were done, she said, you know, the nice thing about the way you talk about this is that you are reminding people of their responsibility for something that they use, and she really liked that. And Jeff was talking to her, and she mentioned that Jeff has the makings of a good nun.
It's the first time I've heard that. But
it
I'll take
the last.
It. I'll take it. I'm updating my Facebook status immediately.
Jeff has the makings of a good nun. But anyway, her point in this was that, look, if we think something's important, we can't wait around for other people to make the world the way it needs to be. We need to take an active role in that. And you may have a variety of things that you support in your life that mean something to you and that you know are important in the community. But you can't deny, you can't honestly to yourself or to us deny that KERA is important to you. As we always say, you're still listening during the membership campaign. You know the content is valuable. Why not decide that a bit of your budget is worth spending on a radio station that brings so much to your life? 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number.
Mike Vincent in Fort Worth has made that decision. Shauna DePuente in Euless has made the decision. Catherine Irwin in Carrollton is on board. Sylvia Pomka in Plano and Steve Lambert in Arlington. Chris, they've all done their part. They've all taken that next step to becoming to a closer relationship with their public radio station. Maybe they're renewing their membership. The great news, the really fantastic news is we've raised, thanks to thousands of you, quite literally, $197,000 so far in this membership campaign. And we're getting closer and closer and closer to halfway to the end. So please be the next one to call. 800-456-5372. Please be the next one to click over to the support page at kera.org and make a contribution there.
We have lots of ways to thank you if you are interested in becoming a member that way. You just call 1-800-456-5372. Talk to the volunteers. They have a whole list of things. If you're not interested in a thank you gift, we will put your entire contribution toward the cost of this programming, as opposed to part of it goes to the thank you gift and part of it goes to the station. However you want to do it, though, in all honesty, we are just happy to hear from you. So please give us a call this afternoon at 1-800-456-5372 or go online to kera.org. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University, Dean Falk. Her new book is called Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. If you'd like to have a copy of the book, you can support KERA at the $120 level, and we will send it to you with our compliments. You just call 1-800-456-5372. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You know, Dean, talking about how language originated with mothers and babies and their interactions, I'm curious about the influence that older siblings would have had who are pretty close to this mother-baby talk, but maybe a couple of years down the line.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure of that. I know today that when I had my children, the older sibling helped me interpret the babbling of the younger sister. And so I think that given the interaction we talked about in the earlier segment about the play groups of the Japanese macaques, that there would have been those kinds of interactions. And children have such, their brains are like little sponges. They are programming their own nervous systems in a way and sopping up information. So I would think that sibling interaction would have been important, and perhaps there would have been a role of the older siblings helping helping translate between mother and younger infants. But that's extremely speculative, and I'm just speaking off the top of my head.
Well, I know there's also a lot of research that says that our ability to fully absorb a language diminishes as we age. Would, mm-hmm. would the younger age of women when they gave birth have had an impact back then?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that the age of the mother would have been so important with that respect, but the age of the infant would have been. In terms of animals in general, and certainly ourselves, the a developing baby is the entire nervous system is programming, and it's very rapid. You know, the brain growth is extremely steep during the first year after birth. And it levels off, you know, in young childhood. But there's very, very rapid development of the nervous system up until we humans go through puberty. And if you learn a foreign language, you'll learn it. If you learn it before puberty, you tend to learn it with the perfect appropriate accent. If you learn it after puberty, you will probably have a foreign accent when you speak that language.
Why do you think for so long theories about the development of language focused on men?
Well, it's not just theories about the development of language. It's theories about human evolution in general. You know, we had the model of man, the hunter, which was almost received wisdom in our textbooks for years and years and years. And there's been this notion, there's still an element of it, that tools were invented by men and that hunting was invented by men and that language was invented by men. And there wasn't until fairly recently much discussion at all about women and children. That changed several decades ago when a number of anthropologists, many of whom were women, decided to look around the world at non-traditional societies and asked the question about, you know, man the hunter. And the question was, who provides the most calories to the family? And what they discovered was that, well, the men were off hunting. The women and children were usually off gathering food, and that, in fact, the brunt of the nutrition came from the gathering efforts. So this brought in the idea of woman the gatherer as opposed to man the hunter. And that's received a favorable response. And then more recently, there's been the idea that, you know, there's been the question of why do we live to be so much older than other primates? And why do we have women that live to be menopausal? That's, you know, why is their life extended so long? And there's something called the grandmother hypothesis, which suggests that grandmothers help their daughters often raise their children. They help with the kids, with their grandchildren, and this frees up mom to have more children or to be more productive in terms of gathering food. So women have come somewhat into their own in recent years with the grandmother hypothesis and woman the gatherer as a kind of balance to the idea of man the hunter. In terms of language, or cognitive things, there hasn't been such a shift. And that's one of the things I attempt to do in this book, is ask a question about language. And I think language was very, very important for, you know, cognitive evolution in general, and that we can make, you know, the case that women and their babies were really important to get it off the ground in the first place.
So if women played the greater adult role in the development of language with their babies than men, does that for you help explain the, and we know this is a generalization, mm-hmm. but the typically slightly higher verbal acuity that women have as compared with men?
You know, I think that that's entirely possible. There are data, and there's strong data, and there are a lot of them, which do suggest that in general, that females are more adept at verbal kinds of skills than males. I hasten to add there's huge overlap, and there are plenty of men that are brilliant verbally. But it's a statistically significant difference, and it may well trace back to prehistory. That's entirely possible. Men, let's give them some credit, tend to perform better on tests that have to do with spatial, visual kinds of skills and navigation kinds of things. And that, too, could trace back to their prehistory. So in terms of evolutionary biology, we always think, you know, ask questions in terms of what's called reproductive fitness. That is, you know, how did certain things develop? How did they help individuals have a better chance in the survival sweepstakes? In other words, reproduce more viable offspring of their own. And those things, those skills, which you have slightly better performance in one sex over another, may well trace back to different, quote, reproductive strategies, unconscious adaptations that enabled a particular sex to be good at producing offspring that carried their genes into the future.
Let's go to the phones now and speak with Susie in Arlington. Hello, Susie.
Oh, hi. Yes, I was going to comment about making up language. When I was littler, I have a twin sister, and we were sharing a bedroom with my older sister. And when we'd be sleeping at night, my older sister said we'd spook her because she would hear me talking to my twin sister, and then my twin sister would respond back to me, but it wasn't in English or any foreign language. It was just like babble talk, and it was like we were responding back to each other, and she said it would scare her. I didn't know if you've ever heard of that, and we don't remember talking in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you remembered. Yes, I have heard of twins having their own secret language. I don't know anything about it, but I sure would love to. I've heard enough to believe it does occur. And if you have words that aren't symbolic, in other words, you're babbling, that would suggest to me that there's an emotional communication there, that you're conveying meaning, but it's emotional rather than very specific in a linguistic kind of way. I would love to know more about that, but unfortunately don't.
And I've left you just a minute to talk about this, which is unfortunate, but can you talk a little bit about the development of art and how this relates to this period in our prehistory?
Yes. Well, I looked at music as a form of art, and I see that as the other side of language, and we don't in a minute have time to go into all the reasons why, except that music also processes complex sounds. They are just emotional in meaning rather than symbolic. In terms of art, I see that as more recent and really developing out of the same kind of neural machinery that underlies both spoken language and music. That is, an ability to dissect the smallest elements of something, to rearrange them, put them together in an infinite variety of forms in order to convey meaning. And if you look at the way children develop their artistic skills, there are exact parallels with, for instance, their acquisition, their earlier acquisition of language. As an example, it takes a while for a child to even be able to scribble on a page, you know, to even get the crayon on the page. But when they do, they scribble. And I think that's like verbal babbling. And then as they learn to draw figures, they do so around the world in certain ways. There are certain elements that come into it. They need to learn to do compositions, to have it well-shaped within a space, the page. So there are lots of parallels there. And then we can go to the fossil record and ask the question, when do you see art appearing? How far back? And how does it develop over time? What new elements are brought in? And it looks similar to the development of artistic skills in children. You know, you get little geometric forms earlier in time before you get pictures of people or pictures of animals.
Really, really tantalizing stuff. Dean Falk is Hale G. Smith Professor of Anthropology at Florida State University. Her book is called Finding Our Tongues, Mothers, Infants, and the Origins of Language. Dean, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, all of you who are listening today, and also, especially, I want to thank those of you who are members of the station, supporters at any level. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372 to become the next new or renewing member of KERA or to make an additional gift. You can also go to kera.org online. If you would like to have a copy of Dean Falk's new book, Finding Our Tongues, we do have that available to give away when you make a contribution of $120 or more. It's simple to do. It takes just about 2 minutes, and we would be ever so grateful if you would take that step.
1-800-456-5372 is the number. The web address, it's kera.org. We've heard from many of you in the last couple of hours, and thanks so much to each and every one of you who has joined the station, who's made a contribution. It's your sort of fueling the fire here, not just for the radio station, not just financially. You're setting an example for everybody else who listens too. You know, when you're listening to the station and you hear a list of names and people out there in your community, maybe they're neighbors of yours, maybe they're people that you might meet someday, maybe they're people that you've never met, maybe you even recognize a name. You know, I would ask you to consider joining those folks, because these are people who are paying the bills for the radio station that you're listening to. And they're trying to encourage you through joining as well to join. So do your part. 800-456-5372, online at kera.org. It's really convenient. You can do the whole pledge process in a couple of minutes, and then you'll be on your way, and you will know that you've done your part for KERA.
You know, you talk about encouraging friends and associates and people you know. I always think that of the people who make an additional gift, who are a member for the year in good standing, and then go ahead and make one more contribution, be it $1,000 or $10. Those folks are clearly trying to send the message, look, I've not only given, but I've given more than once. I've given sort of over my promise, my pledge for the year. We just ask you to make a once-a-year gift, but if you can do an additional one and you believe in the station, consider that you may have a great impact in inspiring someone else to do the same.
I call it the Rollins.
The
Rollins.
Rollins Gilliland.
Yeah, he can't just give once. I'm sure he'll tell the story this afternoon. I'm on the air this afternoon with Rollins.
We're about to get it. Thanks from Rollins.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'll tell the story, but he just can't stand it. He says, you know, I've got to give a little here, give a little there. You know, he hears something he likes, he calls, and he gives $5 or $10. You know, and people do that. We see additional gifts coming up on the screen all the time. And you know what? It is really awesome that you believe in KERA enough to make that step, to make that call to 800-456-5372, or to go to kera.org, hit the support banner, and pledge there.
We want to thank Lori Boswell in Dallas, Andy Patterson in Grand Prairie, Vincent Button in Dallas, Karen Yates in Dallas. You know what's really interesting is that so many of us now have particular things that we believe in and think nothing of asking our friends. You know, I'm doing a walk for this, or my kids are raising money for that. And it wouldn't hurt for you to ask your friends. You don't have to collect the money for us if you don't want to, but ask your friends, hey, I know you listen to KERA. Did you know they're doing the membership campaign right now? And they will probably say, oh, yes, I know. And then ask them, you know, if they've made a contribution.
We could supply you with a selection of mugs.
And we could give you a little script to read and everything.
And a neighborhood to canvas.
1-800-456-5372 is our number.
No, we don't do it that way. We come to you on the air. We ask you to go online to kera.org. We don't go door to door. We haven't yet managed to figure out how to, actually, it's just the best way. The easiest and most efficient way is just to talk directly to you. After all, you're listening. You're listening to the station. You're listening to the end of the Think program here. This is the soundtrack to your day, and you're going to listen to Tell Me More next, and then The World, and then All Things Considered, and you know, you'll hear Marketplace, and you'll hear the News Hour with Jim Lehrer. You'll hear Fresh Air's repeat at 8 o'clock. You know, this is your radio station. If you know the program schedule like that, then and you've not joined the station, then it is far and away
high time.
It is time for you to call.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, and online at kera.org. We have lots of ways to say thank you. We know that the vast majority of you, whether or not you take a thank you gift, we know that you don't join just to get the thank you gift, because you could buy just about everything for less than the cost of a membership, all of it, in fact. We know that you're doing it to support KERA, but if a thank you gift is something that will inspire you to make the call as opposed to not making the call, by all means. We do want to let you know that even if you don't choose to take a thank you gift, we will put your name in this drawing for the British Airways trip to London for two, along with a $1,000 Marriott Hotel gift credit, and you will get a tour of the BBC studios, which would be a nice little plus.
Yeah, they're round trip tickets in business class, and you know, it's somebody's going to win this trip. The minute the drive ends, we are going to draw from everyone who has called or gone online, who has pledged or asked to be entered into the drawing. So you know, that could be you. And when you're checking that information out online, please do click the support button and join the station. Decide that a $60 membership and a KERA Green T-shirt or a Think mug is a thank you gift that you'd like to have, a token of your support for KERA. And we find that the Think mugs come in handy in meetings too, because you can hold it up and sort of
point to it,
gesture with it slightly or very subtly.
And my parents and Jeff's parents can't use the entire supply of Think mugs that the station has. I think my parents have quite a collection now. But please give us a call right now. We do appreciate your support. It really does matter. If you're thinking that it only matters that other people give, please disabuse yourself of that, because we need you. 1-800-456-5372 is the number to call to take a stand in the name of public radio. You can also do this online at kera.org. We really sincerely appreciate your support. Thank you.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.